It's Berlin briefing time. The debate here is on whether and how much Germany will have to step up and potentially send troops to Ukraine. It may be early days in the negotiations, but Europe's largest economy may soon get asked to provide what all Ukraine allies just asked Donald Trump to guarantee during their historic meeting with him in the White House.
First one is security guarantees.
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 So that message was clear. So today we want to talk about how spooked the German public and many politicians here are about the prospect of committing German boots on the ground. DW's Nina Haase is with me in the studio for that. And John Bolton joins us from Washington, D.C. As former UN ambassador and national security advisor to Donald Trump during his first term, you are in a unique position to give us a reality check on what the American, what Trump's expectations will be. Is Germany, the Europeans doing their homework and using this time of uncertainty over the negotiation process to get ready for what a peace deal could bring and demand?
Well, I think despite all of the activity over the past 2 weeks, from the time basically of the Anchorage summit or a little bit before that until today, despite all that activity, I don't think much has changed in terms of Russia's position, on which I've seen no movement at all. Really, on the battlefield, the same conditions apply. And I think Ukraine is in the same difficult place it was before. So I'm very worried that there's a lot of talk about security guarantees before we've overcome some of the absolutely critical questions like division of territory. Remember, one of the first things that Donald Trump said after his conversation with Putin before the summit was land swaps, sort of a real estate developer's view of international affairs. Will trade a few lots here and there, and that'll resolve the problem. That's what I think Putin essentially put to them. That's obviously just a small part of it, but for the Russians and for the Ukrainians, critical before we get to anything like what else is put in place to ensure there's not a third Russian invasion of Ukraine in the near future.
So there still is this area of uncertainty, whether even a meeting will take place, whether Zelensky and Putin will in fact sit down, who else will potentially be at the table, and whether that actually are negotiations. Within all of this uncertainty, we've also heard from Ben Hodges, the former NATO commander here in Europe, saying that potentially thousands, tens of thousands of European troops would be needed to secure any kind of peace deal. Do you share that assessment? And is that something that certainly German Chancellor Friedrich Merz should be preparing his public for?
Well, I think let's start with what may be the terms of the security guarantees first, because I think that's important. People talk about what they describe as an Article 5-like provision that that some coalition of the willing would afford to Ukraine, because it's clear that NATO has been ruled out qua NATO by both Russia and Donald Trump. So when you say Article 5-like, it's people say they remember the phrase, an attack on one shall be deemed an attack on all, which is a very strong phrase, but they forget the phrase that occurs a little bit later in Article 5, describing what the obligation of each NATO member is, and that is to take, and I'm quoting now, such activity as it deems appropriate. Now, that is a very vague phrase. And over decades of NATO's lifespan, it's come to mean the use of military force because of the presence of American forces in Europe more than anything else. But it could mean a country, you know, you could pick Hungary as an example, that on hearing of the third invasion of Ukraine might send Ukraine a note saying, very sorry to hear you've been invaded again. Best of luck. Do let us know how it turns out. So I'm not sure that putting faith in an Article 5-like provision gets you very far. But let's say you formulate the language that satisfies Ukraine. Then the next question is there going to be some kind of additional force in Ukraine to help implement that security guarantee? And before we talk about how many troops are necessary, the first thing you have to do is define what the mission of the force is. Would it be like a UN peacekeeping operation, which many of which I have dealt with, which basically observe and report on violations of ceasefires back to the Security Council? And their rules of engagement are such that they're authorized to use force only in self-defense. or is it what is sometimes called a peace enforcement mission, which is troops that are prepared to move against the violator of a ceasefire, to engage in combat against that violator, to restore the ceasefire. Now, if you're talking about that, then you're talking about war between NATO members and Russia. I think we could have done a lot before February the 24th, 2022, to deter the Russians from invading to begin with, although we didn't, by thinking more along those lines. But Donald Trump has already said there won't be any American boots on the ground. He has said, you know, as of the time we're speaking here right now, that he could see American air power involved. But he has not said whether that would be American combat aircraft or whether it would be American transport aircraft. Now, our transport system is great. We have the biggest in the free world, and it's very important. But it's not the same as an A-10 Warthog providing close air to support to infantry under attack from Russians. Nor does it imply using strategic bombers or even fighter bombers like the F-16 in support of European troops fighting the Russians. So somebody better decide pretty quickly whether they're prepared to have the risk of combat with Russian forces in order to create the deterrence we hope will emerge that deters the Russian attack to begin with. I would be much more prepared to contemplate that from the U.S. point of view than I'm afraid Donald Trump's MAGA base will be willing to contemplate it. So don't get too excited in Europe about whatever you've heard from Trump in the past 2 weeks.
Well, and you already alluded to that clear statement that Donald Trump made, that there wouldn't be American boots on the ground. Here in Europe, we see leaders stress that this would all take place alongside the United States. And I just want to take a listen to what Friedrich Merz, the German chancellor, was asked by our bureau chief in Washington, Ines Paul, when he came out of that meeting. We slightly edited the answer to get quicker to the point.
Chancellor, would you be willing to send German peacekeeping troops to Ukraine?
In welchem Umfang?
We will have to discuss the scope of that here in Europe, and of course I will also have to discuss that with my coalition in Berlin. Also the question whether German parliament will have to decide on a mandate. But today it is too early to give a clear answer to that.
So, Nina, why does the German chancellor not sound as decisive anymore as those European leaders who just an hour before he came out and made that comment and gave that answer were rather forcefully calling for security guarantees from the US?
Because there are so many open questions, right? Especially the role of the US, especially the point, what exactly does Ukraine have to cede to Russia to find some sort of an agreement? So the Europeans really want clear answers, and they say that they don't want the fourth step before the first. So Friedrich Merz is not going to say, yes, I'm going to deploy troops to Ukraine for a foreign policy reason, because he needs to know about, you know, territorial discussions when it comes to Ukraine. He needs to have answers when it comes to what would that long-lasting peace in Ukraine even mean on the ground. I mean, would that be a negotiated outcome? Would that just be a frozen conflict with the risk of it escalating again, some sort of a different solution as well? And then also, he is very aware that he needs his army, is a parliamentary army here in Germany. So he does need to keep in mind that he would have to convince the German parliament. He has to convince the German public, in a sense, as well. And that needs, of course, to be completely clear what kind of a mandate that would even be. So we're hearing three messages here in Berlin this week. One is a very big sigh of relief still that the Washington summit went as it did, that Ukraine wasn't thrown under the bus, because many people after that Anchorage meeting that John Bolton just mentioned, of course, many people had also feared here in Europe that Trump would just go ahead and demand capitulation from Ukraine. That was a very clear threat. So the Europeans decided to go and join Zelensky in D.C. So that sigh of relief is still here. But of course, then all these questions arise, you know, security guarantees, who pays for the peace, etc. So foreign policy issues. And then Friedrich Merz has got his problems at home. Very, very, very difficult situation, especially because the current German government is still not in a position to tell the German public that really what we need is mandatory conscription, because otherwise the German army can buy all the equipment it needs, but has no personnel to operate that equipment. And so far, they're still shying away from confronting the German public with that reality. They're saying they're going to make that announcement. We're going to announce a form of voluntary conscription. We've talked about this on this podcast many times now. So that is going to go through the cabinet next week. But so far, it says voluntary conscription. And how are you going to then have a situation where you deploy troops to Ukraine? You don't know how many, you don't know where, you don't know with what mandate, and you don't know where they could come from, because we're already lacking soldiers. So, of course, a very, very tricky situation for Friedrich Merz.
Well, what the German government has stressed here is that it's going to be a very broad set of security guarantees, that this is not limited to what everybody seems to be zooming in on, which is potential boots on the ground and these reassurances. But we did hear, and Ambassador Bolton, I would like to confront you with that, we did hear the German foreign minister speak about a potential overstretch of the German Bundeswehr. Now, how does this kind of talk go down with Donald Trump after a meeting like this? Is this something that Friedrich Merz really has to watch out for in terms of what message he is sending?
Summer is here and vacation is calling. So at the end of July, we're bringing you a special series with our favorite tips for living a greener life. From what to look out for in your sunscreen to how to reduce your dog's environmental paw print, we'll get insights and advice from the experts and have a look at our own habits. Find our Greener Living series from Living Planet wherever you get podcasts.
Well, my guess is that Trump really thinks this is up to Europeans. And I think that sentiment was conveyed Tuesday night in a dinner, I believe, that the U.S. chairman of our Joint Chiefs of Staff hosted for his counterparts from the European countries that attended the meeting in the White House on Monday, and where policy level officials, civilians at the Defense Department, essentially said, don't count on us for much of anything. You have to remember what Donald Trump is looking for here. He's not thinking strategically about what the U.S. interest in Ukraine are. He wants the Nobel Peace Prize. Did you know he resolved a war earlier this year between Serbia and Kosovo? You may not be aware that war had been underway, but he solved it, which shows just how effective he is. And I hope Chancellor Merz will nominate him for the Nobel Peace Prize, too. That would be one way to strengthen his ties with Donald Trump. Look, this was, in Trump's mind, a quick way to do what he said he would do in the campaign, which is solve the Ukraine issue in 24 hours. No, nobody except him believed that, and obviously it didn't happen. He's tried for 6 months and failed, but he saw an opportunity and had a quick summit with Putin. When he announced it the Friday before the Friday meeting in Anchorage, he said, I wish we could do it sooner. Even this summit was the fastest prepared summit for leaders at that level, probably in world history. And, you know, then suddenly European leaders are showing up at the White House. There's going to be a bilateral meeting between Trump and Zelensky. Don't hold your breath on that, or a trilateral meeting with Trump involved. You know, if you're of the view you can bounce Ukraine and Russia into a peace deal in a couple of weeks and therefore get the Nobel Prize for it, you're not concerned about details like what troops on the ground or what their mission is or anything else. Does Ukraine give up the rest of Donetsk Oblast or what? So what? All you want to do is say, see, I brought peace just like I did between Serbia and Albania.
So is the whole concept of him wanting a Nobel Peace Prize, you clearly seem to also be convinced that that's what he really wants. Is that something that someone like German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, whom he clearly respects, we did see that in that meeting, could harness to get a concession in terms of, for him, for instance, going back once again and demanding that ceasefire that everybody wants, because Russia does continue to attack Ukraine every night?
Well, I think Trump now says he could accept a truce. I'm not sure what the real difference between a truce and a ceasefire is. But I think, again, we're still getting ahead of ourselves unless there's some clearer indication of just how much of a concession that Ukraine's going to have to make on territory before there's even a ceasefire. And that's one reason why these rushed, unprepared meetings ultimately are not going to produce much. This war has been going on for 3.5 years. The issues between Russia and Ukraine are deep historical issues. If all this were simple, Trump could have gotten it resolved in 24 hours, but they're not simple and they're not susceptible to leaders getting around a table and having discussions and then trying to figure out what they agreed to, which is what's been happening both in Anchorage and I think in Washington.
Well, one thing we certainly observed here, Nina, isn't it, that Friedrich Merz and his government has been very quick to adjust to new dynamics unfolding, didn't judge them very much. And what are the preparations we're seeing here in Berlin at the moment being made in terms of what the next demand could be that Germany, that Europe has to face, depending on how these potential talks, and one has to be so careful here because it's all up in the air, progress?
There are talks behind closed doors, of course. People here are working frantically, but of course they're working with a completely chaotic scenario on the table. They really just don't know, have to improvise. And I think Germans, Europeans as a whole, they're trying to get used to this Trump approach of doing things, as John Bolton just described, while they're trying to essentially avoid more fatalities here in their neighborhood in Europe. So while Trump appears to Europeans as being at the feeling like he's at the center stage of a TV soap opera and he's doing politics that way, you know, he's staging all these big summits, nothing substantial comes out of it. Sometimes there's drama like we saw earlier this year, and the Europeans are going, hang on, people are dying right here, right just a couple of hours on the plane from here. Russia is attacking a real country. Russia is attacking international law. So the Europeans are having to get that into their way of thinking as well at the same time. How do we help Trump produce good TV pictures so that he stays on board? Because very really is of high importance to the Europeans to keep the Americans on board. At the same time, try and find ways of becoming less dependent on the Americans and trying to find ways of keeping Ukraine supported. But we hear the German foreign minister and he says, I don't even know if Putin is going to come to such a meeting. But you have to be so careful. This dynamics that you just mentioned, you know, some journalists also pick up the words peace negotiations about Ukraine. We're not there yet. This is not peace negotiations. This is Trump meeting with Putin. This is Trump meeting with Zelensky. And it has nothing to do with negotiating how peace can be brought to Ukraine.
And yet there's a political domestic risk for Friedrich Merz. Explain.
Well, of course, Friedrich Merz is under a lot of pressure from the far-right AfD party, where the co-leader, Alice Weidel, has said the hawks in the CDU can hardly wait to send German soldiers to foreign war zones again. And they've also published a tweet that is using pretty drastic imagery, sort of reminding us of almost, it's almost Nazi style.
Yeah, let's take a look at that.
We'll take a look at that right now. And it says, Merz does not want to rule out sending German soldiers to Ukraine. That would not be peacekeeping, but a permanent escalation against Russia. We say clearly, we will not send you to Ukraine. And they show these five young people who are looking very, very grim and negative indeed. And Ambassador, we would just like your reaction.
And a diabolic Friedrich Merz hovering over them and saying, Merz wants to send you to Ukraine. We don't, yeah. The AfD.
Well, I don't doubt the chancellor's got a difficult political task. It's, I would think, not just with the AfD, but with the Social Democrats as well on this, because it looks so warlike to deploy military forces anywhere. But it is, I think, more fundamental that we have to decide how do these forces fit into the security guarantee itself. I'm pretty sure Germany has authorized troops to go into UN peacekeeping missions. So if it were purely a peacekeeping operation, I think it'd be hard for anybody to object to that. But let's face it, as dangerous as any military assignment like that is, the peacekeepers just watch the ceasefire violations occur or whatever else is going to go on, much like they did during the genocide in Rwanda in the 1990s. So it is very important to decide what that mission is. Yeah, there are a lot of examples of it. That's what UN peacekeepers traditionally do. They are not authorized to try and fix the situation, but to report on it.
And by the way, even that would have to go through Bundeswehr. Would have to go through the Bundestag. Small emission as you can have, as soon as there is a risk that people who work for the Bundeswehr may be forced to use weapons, then that needs to be mandated by the German parliament.
Although the Social Democrats are remarkably, I'd say, tame on the whole question of troop deployment. We see the former coalition heads, former parliamentary group heads being very vocal, being against it. We even actually see a conservative CDU state premier being against it. There's a clear difference between Eastern and West German polling. But at the same time, the Social Democrats are very restrained. Lars Klingbeil, the vice chancellor, he spoke of a potential UN mission, OSCE mission, that all of this should be checked before talking about Germany potentially sending troops. But he's not ruling it out, is he?
No, he's not ruling it out. And of course, he's got all those people who still believe that you need to explore all possibilities of finding a diplomatic solution, etc. And he has to be very, very careful. At the same time, Lars Klingbeil, who's the finance minister, but also Friedrich Merz's deputy, so a very strong man in the current government, as well as Boris Pistorius, the German defense minister, the most popular German politician still, they're both in this camp that has understood the reality on the ground in Ukraine, and they do approach matters with a very pragmatic concept normally, but they know that their party base is very strong. And that is also something that I think differentiates Germany from other countries where, you know, the French president can just decide to send soldiers somewhere around the world. Here, the chancellor has very little say. His party is very strong. His government is very strong. So all of this needs to be negotiated. But of course, when you hear statements that come from people from the left party, but also from some chapters of the SPD saying the UN should play a role, then I just don't understand how, because the UN, that would mean you would have to get Russia to approve it.
Yes, it would.
Well, Russia's already suggested that. Mm. Yeah, Russia's already suggested that. Sergei Lavrov, their foreign minister, said this is something that ought to involve the five permanent members of the Security Council, meaning both Russia and China. That's the way to have proper security guarantees. This is something I think the Russians proposed back in Turkey 22 or 23 in the one failed effort there. You know, in the U.S., people would just ignore the five permanent members of the Security Council. But in much of the world, it carries a sense of legitimacy. So the Russians may have found something here that gives some kind of cover for what they're trying to do.
Against that backdrop, I just want to play that soundbite from the German foreign minister, Johann Wadefuhr, who's asking essentially where Putin is at this moment.
Where's the yes from Putin? All we are seeing is how he keeps attacking Ukraine every day.
So where's that yes, and do you expect it? And what do you see as the motivation behind Russia potentially playing ball in the UN Security Council?
Well, I think the Russians think that they've got Trump back as Vladimir's friend, sort of doing what he wants. And when the president was flying up to Alaska, he said, we're either going to come out with a ceasefire agreement or there will be very severe consequences. And there was no ceasefire and no severe consequences. On our Sunday talk shows a few days ago, Secretary of State Rubio, in response to several questions, given nothing came out of all these meetings really concrete, will you begin now to consider applying sanctions to Russia as the president threatened? And Rubio said, no, this is the worst thing to do at this point would be to apply pressure for Russia because that would sink the possibility of a peace agreement. We'd consider sanctions only if the whole process completely broke down. Well, as long as the Russians can ride it up to but not beyond that point, I think that's what they're going to try and do. I don't see much progress here. I think the next appropriate point where you might get a meeting with Zelensky and Putin and Trump or separate meetings could be the convening of the UN General Assembly in New York in September. That's another month away. Well, nothing happens.
Well, and the killing continues. That will actually continue. That's a very bleak outlook to leave us with, Ambassador. Maybe we can conclude with you giving your piece of advice to German Chancellor Merz, who clearly has a very good rapport with the US president at this moment in time.
Well, I think at some point somebody's got to say, look, it was pressure, the sanctions against India, which have cost the U.S. dearly in diplomatic terms with India, driving India back toward Russia and China. But it was the threat of those sanctions against Russia and its trading partners that probably brought Putin to Alaska to begin with. If you don't begin to apply him again, we're going to kiss any kind of peace deal here goodbye.
And Nina, just one assessment from your side. Will Germany have the willingness, the resolve, and will Merz have the majority in the end if it comes down to a German role on the ground?
I think what Friedrich Merz now has to do is stress the importance of working together internationally. Germany and the Europeans are not in a position at the moment. So I think there are a lot of hopes on that coalition of the willing, the German foreign minister, you know, that involves also non-European partners like Japan. So if they work together with those partners, then that is a way. The risk is that Friedrich Merz, Germany and the Europeans find themselves isolated, like John Bolton says, that at some point Donald Trump loses interest and just says, look, Europe, this is your problem, right?
And quite clearly, this also will define how Germany spells out that Zeitenwende that it has promised. Nina Hase, thank you very much for your analysis there. Also to you, Ambassador Bolton, thank you so much for your time today. We know you're very busy at this particular moment and happy to have you on with your analysis, particularly on how Donald Trump's thinking could pan out in the coming weeks and months. And with that, you are fully briefed up. That's Berlin Briefing on that those next steps that the German government will potentially have to take and what debate it has sparked here in Germany. Don't forget to catch up on all German developments with the weekly Berlin Briefing newsletter and do tell us what you would like to get briefed up on. And below, you can find plenty more information and do share your comments.